From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In response to the global challenge posed by religious extremism, a small group of impassioned atheists has taken a new approach. They target the tolerant with both reason and ridicule. The new atheists, as they were dubbed by Gary Wolfe in a recent article in Wired magazine, condemn, quote, not just belief in God, but respect for belief in God. Religion is not only wrong, it's evil. This month, the New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof condemned the new atheists as obnoxious and militant and in your face. And he wrote that this, quote, charge of the atheist brigade in its treatment of conservative Christians is, quote, often just as intolerant and mean.
Atheism already had a PR problem. Then came Sam Harris, author of Letter to a Christian Nation. When he wrote that since 20% of all recognized pregnancies end in miscarriage, God is, quote, the most prolific abortionist of all, he really made people mad. Harris is one of the most vocal spokesmen for the so-called new atheists, along with Oxford scientist Richard Dawkins, author of The God Delusion. They wield logic like a bludgeon, so much so that even Comedy Central's South Park, a series that has savaged Scientology, Christian fundamentalism, and the Mormons, got out the knives.
Let us not forget the great Richard Dawkins, who finally freed the world of religion long ago. Dawkins knew that logic and reason were the way of the future. But it wasn't until he met his beautiful wife that he learned using logic and reason isn't enough. You have to be a dick to everyone who doesn't think like you.
Sam Harris concedes he's on a mission to make moderates less moderate.
Because moderates insist that we respect their religious faith, we can't criticize the role that religious faith is playing in dividing people.
And Harris says moderates are mistaken if they believe the wall between church and state can protect us from extremists. They've already scaled it.
If you think the creator of the universe is letting people fly planes into our buildings because we are tolerating gay marriage, or he's whipping up hurricanes in the Gulf because we're tolerating gay marriage, you have to try to legislate against gay marriage. And if you think the creator of the universe is going to be scandalized by the mere depiction of Muhammad, you have to take to the streets and start rioting. There's nothing intolerant or mean or fundamentalist or dogmatic about opposing this kind of delusion.
Real life differs from culture wars in the media.
Gary Wolfe wrote about the new atheists in Wired magazine. He says that the blunt tactics used by the new atheists cannot be applied to personal arguments over faith, where delicate family and work relationships might hang in the balance. He says the polemics of new atheism can be just as nasty as the fundamentalists.
So while I don't accuse the atheists of being fundamentalists, the rhetoric they use resonates with the religious rhetoric that controls much of our cultural debate today.
Sam Harris.
There's nothing fundamentalist about rejecting the claim that the universe is 6,000 years old.
Yes, there is, says Christian Coalition founder Pat Robertson, speaking on the 700 Club.
What we've got to recognize just there in this case is that the evolutionists worship atheism. I mean, that's their religion. So this is an establishment of religion contrary to the First Amendment of the United States Constitution.
If, in fact, atheism were a religion, it might get more respect.
that label evokes a strong negative response in American life.
Penny Edgell is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Minnesota. In 2003, she and her colleagues, Doug Hartman and Joe Gratis, conducted a national poll to determine which of 10 ethnic and religious groups the average American would least like their children to marry.
We had included atheists on the list as a group that we expected would have low levels of disapproval. And therefore, we thought, well, that will be a good yardstick against which to measure other kinds of attitudes. We were really very surprised.
Atheists were deemed the least desirable. Muslims did better in 2003, and gays and lesbians, maybe because most respondents had at least seen one or two. But research suggests avowed atheists are few and far between.
Just do the numbers, right? If they're only 7% of the American population, odds are most people don't know one.
People fear what they don't know, and so they tend to be suspicious of the absence of a presence in the lives of atheists.
It is religion, having a faith, that makes people in the American context seem trustworthy, like good citizens and good neighbors. So if you don't have that as a moral boundary, you're an outsider, an other, and perhaps a dangerous other.
We're all familiar with phrases like, you know, I have to say it, Jews are cheap, Italians are in the mafia, blacks are on welfare, gays are promiscuous, and atheists are immoral.
Ellen Johnson is the president of American Atheists, but the phrase she hates most of all goes a little something like this.
Perhaps you've heard the expression, there are no atheists in foxholes.
Wartime, there are no atheists in foxholes.
To amend the old saying about foxholes, there are no atheists driving trucks in Iraq.
That was CBS's Katie Couric and Bob Schieffer and NPR's John Burnett. Those were just the three we got tape of. News people say it all the time. Ellen Johnson.
It's demeaning to atheists. It's saying that under very dire circumstances or frightening situations, atheists will stop being atheists. They will start to be leaving. And this is really just a wish on the part of the religious because it's not based in fact.
I thought it was a good line for the tape.
NPR's John Burnett.
And I didn't realize that it was so offensive to atheists. And I learned that in spades after the story came out. They spammed me for weeks with email saying, we're outraged. So now I know.
And did you sort of see their point?
I do see their point. I literally hadn't thought about it before. And frankly, I will think twice about using the phrase again.
So if the news media aren't sensitive to atheists, Hollywood must be, right? I mean, the political right says it's so gay and liberal and irreligious.
Faith. That's another word for ignorance, isn't it?
That's Dr. Gregory House, a brilliant if antisocial diagnostician and the main character in the Fox medical drama, House. He's also an atheist. In a recent episode, House comes up against a teenaged faith healer who seems to be curing a patient with terminal cancer.
The fear for the human race. A teenager claims to be the voice of God and people with advanced degrees are listening.
In a hospital staff lounge, a colleague posts a scoreboard with two columns, House versus God. Whenever House can't explain a medical result, says David Shore, creator of the series,
God got a check mark. When House explains something, House got a check mark.
At the end of the show, on that little tally board, you left it at a draw.
Yes.
But I think you were actually pulling your punches a little there, weren't you?
I hope not. Maybe. I do it sometimes. I don't know.
Yes, he does, because House actually found a medical explanation for everything the faith healer claimed to be doing through God. Hollywood usually pulls its punches on atheism. Mostly, TV atheists are lost souls, like Jen in the teenage drama Dawson's Creek that ran from 1998 to 2003. Here was Jen in the series premiere.
You know, I don't do real well with church and the Bible and this prayer stuff.
I beg your pardon?
I don't covet a religious God, Grams. I'm an atheist.
And here she is in the series finale, terminally ill, taping a farewell message to her baby daughter.
I've never really believed in God, but I hope that you are able to believe in God. Because the thing that I've come to realize, sweetheart, is that it just doesn't matter if God exists or not. The important thing is for you to believe in something.
There's very few openly atheistic people on television, and I find that a little surprising.
House creator and writer David Shore.
Atheists to me fall in the same category to some extent as lawyers, in the sense that people hate them in general, but like their own. They know House, they like House. They don't care he's an atheist, I don't think.
You know, I get it. People are just looking for a way to fill the holes. But they want the holes. They want to live in the holes. And they go nuts when someone else pours dirt in their holes. Climb out of your holes, people!
I like that one. I like that one a lot.
But even Shore is inclined to believe there are no atheists in foxholes, or at least hospitals.
To ignore issues of faith is to ignore a pretty fundamental part of all people's lives when they're in the hospital facing death. I'm not saying all people find God, but they certainly do ask those questions.
What's an atheist to do? American Atheist President Ellen Johnson says they have to organize.
Until the atheists start voting their atheism and be identified as a voting bloc in America, the politicians aren't going to listen to us. We're not going to have any influence in the public schools. We're not going to have any influence in the media or anywhere else.
But even she concedes that organizing atheists is like herding cats. Sam Harris says the only way to win is to keep up the pressure until religious tolerance is no longer tolerated.
I think the criticism of irrationality just has to come from 100 sides all at once in the entertainment community. I mean, you'll just have people making jokes that are funny enough and true enough so as to put religious certainty in a bad light.
We know atheists are brave.
Comedy Central's Stephen Colbert.
They're not afraid to go to hell and be tortured by Satan for all eternity, which is what's going to happen.
One day, someone in the White House press corps will hear the President of the United States express some certainty about being in dialogue with the creator of the universe, and he or she will ask a question which should be on everybody's mind. How is this any different from thinking you're in dialogue with Zeus?
That day is far off. But Harris has a great deal of faith in his fellow man.
I'm hopeful that journalists and people in the entertainment industry are waiting for the permission to express their doubts. And I think that permission is coming. I mean, I'm trying to do what I can to engineer it in my hard-headed and boorish way. And I feel just from the contacts I have in both industries that there's a profound sense of relief that comes with hearing somebody call a spade a spade.
Was that what Stephen Colbert was doing when he addressed an audience of Hollywood elite at the Emmys this year?
Good evening, godless sodomites.
Harris may have no tolerance for the gospel, but as an atheist trying to enlist Hollywood in his crusade, Colbert's greeting has to sound like some kind of good news. Coming up, Pinochet and the press, and a full-on retreat from the phrase war on terror.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The death this week of Chile's former dictator has rekindled many a bad memory of the Augusto Pinochet regime. Most disturbingly, the disappearance of more than 3,000 people, most on the political left, at the hands of Pinochet's secret police in the early 1970s. Not only were the Chilean media largely silent about widespread arrests, torture, and murder, several large news organizations were accomplices in a cover-up, behavior that was foreshadowed even before Pinochet overthrew the democratically elected socialist government of the late Salvatore Allende. The collusion of Pinochet's forces with the Chilean media oligarch and the CIA has been documented by author Peter Kornbluh, director of the National Security Archives Chile Documentation Project. Revisiting those dark days, Kornbluh told us that the U.S. government was so eager to dislodge the leftists that they conspired with the owner of Chile's largest newspaper, El Mercurio.
Well, the El Mercurio empire was owned by the richest man in Chile, Agustin Edwards. He had very good friends at the highest levels of the U.S. government. His media empire received more than $2 million, some of it approved specifically by the President of the United States, Richard Nixon. And I'm not saying this is my own analytical opinion. The CIA documents that we've obtained the declassification of, they say that the propaganda operation, passing these millions of dollars into the Agustin Edwards media empire, quote, set the stage, unquote, for the coup of September 11th, 1973.
The disappearances began between 1973 and 1975. At one point, 119 Chileans were murdered by the regime and were reputed to have been found in Argentina. Tell me about this. It's what they called Operation Colombo.
The regime had already disappeared hundreds of Chilean leftists, and now they face this issue, how to make the disappeared reappear. And that was the crux of Operation Colombo. And essentially, it involved planting bodies on the streets of Buenos Aires, bodies that could not be identified. The hands were burned off. Some of them were headless or the faces were burned, with IDs on them, identifying them as several of the Chilean disappeared.
And the idea was to suggest that they had been killed not by Pinochet's secret police, but by their own fellow travelers. And they planted stories in the Argentine media, but they went to great lengths to do that.
Worse than planting story in the Argentine media, they simply created their own magazine. They called it Lea, which in English means read. It was a magazine that was only published once. It ended up on the newsstands of all the kiosks in Buenos Aires 3 days after several of these bodies were found. And it basically was an article that said that Chilean leftists had come to Argentina. They were fighting among themselves and killing themselves. And it gave a list of 60 Chileans, all of whom were disappeared in Chile, but now, according to this article, had been killed in fighting among each other in Argentina. 1 week later, another propaganda piece appeared in a newsletter in Brazil and said the same thing, that they'd been fighting among themselves or simply killed one another.
It's phenomenal. And these stories were deemed sufficient enough evidence for the Chilean media to cite them as evidence that the leftists indeed were behind these murders. There's one extraordinary headline in a Chilean paper. Tell me about it.
La Segunda, which was one of Chile's most leading newspapers owned by Agustin Edwards, printed a headline that said, Miristas exterminated like rats. Miristas is the name of the leftist group that Pinochet claimed all of these individuals belonged to. Well, you have to understand that it wasn't just that this appeared in the press. A DINA agent, a secret police agent of Chile, carried these stories to the press. And then El Mercurio, the leading newspaper in Chile, printed a whole editorial, basically, that could have been written by the Chilean secret police itself. And this is what it said, quote, the politicians and foreign newsmen who asked themselves so many times about the fate of these leftists and blame the Chilean government for the disappearances of many of them now have the explanation that they refuse to accept. Victims of their own methods, exterminated by their own comrades, every one of them demonstrates with tragic eloquence that violent people end up falling victims to the blind and implacable terror that they provoke. So it was a whole manipulation of the truth of what had happened. But many Chileans, particularly upper-class Chileans, read this and said, aha, we knew all along that, you know, the left kills each other. Pinochet is clean. He would never do such a thing.
So, in effect, they bought the story. What about the rest of the international community? Was it as easily gulled as the Chilean elites?
No, and this is a story where credit is due. The U.S. press really played an extraordinary role in very quickly unraveling this extraordinary effort to cover up the disappearances of hundreds of Chileans by the Pinochet regime. They very, very quickly were able to say this is a bizarre set of lies. And it's very interesting when you read the declassified cable traffic from the embassy to see the role that these accounts in the U.S. press played in forcing the embassy to actually admit itself that the Chilean military had killed these people.
And tell me about today in Chile. In 2006, are oligarchs like Agustin Edwards still the arbiters of what the public will see, hear, and read?
Agustin Edwards still owns El Mercurio. El Mercurio is not the leading newspaper anymore. La Tercera is the leading newspaper in Chile now, and it's owned by another wealthy family and also has a whole network of newspapers and radio stations, etc. One of the things that's significantly changed in Chile, of course, is that the government is headed by a socialist. And the government does take out advertising in a number of newspapers, and that funding through government advertising does help those newspapers be able to print information that is not just controlled by the wealthy Chilean newspaper owners. But by and large, you know, people get their information from television. And so there's still a small but significant segment of the Chilean community who believes that Pinochet is a victim of left-wing propaganda, that he never really committed any human rights atrocities, even to this day, as we have seen recently with Pinochet's funeral. You know, and some of them simply had this see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil view of the Pinochet regime that was fanned by the Chilean media at the height of the dictatorship.
Peter, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Peter Kornbluh is director of the National Security Archives Chile Documentation Project and author of The Pinochet File, a Declassified Dossier on Atrocity and Accountability.
This week in England, early reports of a study of the British media just completed by academics at the University of Leeds in Liverpool. They examined 6 weeks of coverage, beginning just prior to the war in Iraq, through shock and awe, and ending soon after the toppling of Saddam's statue in Baghdad. The study, called Media Wars, looks at virtually all of England's national newspapers and at the four main TV news programs. And it found that 80% of media followed the government's line in regard to the war, and less than 12% challenged it. Peter Goddard is a lecturer at the University of Liverpool and one of the study's authors.
What we were surprised about was that we saw this as being a very different kind of war to many of the ones that have been studied in the past, because in Britain at least there was a very substantial public opposition to war in Iraq, more than 50% of the population shortly before the war began. So we expected to find more evidence that that viewpoint had also been represented in the media, but by and large it hadn't been. Mostly, the news reported in line with what I suppose we would say the coalition would have wished for, what was good news for the coalition.
Did you find much diversity within the findings?
Well, in the press we did. We're able to even to group them into pro-war and anti-war newspapers. But we found that the agenda that the newspapers followed was broadly similar, regardless of their positions. They all reported the same stories, broadly speaking. By far, the most substantial part of the coverage was taken up with coverage of the battle itself. We found a very event-driven coverage. As soon as the conflict began, much of the discussion of the rights and wrongs of the conflict disappeared, and both press and television were really concerned only with what had happened in the previous 24 hours, whether the coalition had been successful or had failed, how much opposition they'd faced, and so on.
You had the phenomenon of embedded reporters. You had pictures from the field. Naturally, the coverage would be event-driven because for once, and for the first time in decades, there was such an abundance of images from the theater of war.
Oh, naturally. The problem, of course, though, is if you have too much focus on events and too little context in which those events can be understood, there's the danger that the events themselves crowd out any explanation of why governments or the military is behaving in the way that it is, or of what consequences in the wider sense it might have, say, for Western relations with the Middle East or for the people of Iraq themselves or whatever.
You said that 50% of Britons opposed the war.
Slightly over in the weeks shortly before the war.
Talk to me about the coverage of dissent. Was there anything surprising about that?
There was very little coverage of dissent compared to the extent of dissent in the British population. We found, for example, looking at the kinds of people who were accessed in television news, that 55% of those people who spoke on TV news were coalition representatives of one sort or another. The UK anti-war representatives amounted to about 4% of people who were accessed. It was slightly different in relation to members of parliament, for example, who disagreed with the war. A couple of prominent members of parliament were featured quite heavily in the early part of the conflict period. But by and large, their appearances only coincided later on with reasons to dismiss their arguments.
You noted that Channel 4 News was the most successful at maintaining its autonomy from the government, especially with regard to the war's justification.
Yes.
How and why do you think that is?
Well, I should probably put this in context first. We felt in designing this study that autonomy was an important issue here, that the journalists should be allowed to tell their own stories and to inform their audiences in an independent way about the war, which is not the same necessarily as being critical of it, simply not taking on trust what the government says or what the military says about the war. So we were looking for autonomy, and this is a particularly important issue because, as you probably know, the BBC was very heavily criticised during and after the war by the government for apparently having been biased against the government or the coalition position. We found little justification for the criticism of the BBC. We found the BBC had been very neutral in its coverage of the war. Channel 4 News was the most anti-war, as you say, and the reason for that, I think, is partly because Channel 4 News is aimed at a different audience. It's a news program which is concerned with in-depth information rather than gaining higher ratings. It runs for nearly an hour, which gives it the scope to probe behind the stories that are in the headlines more than shorter news bulletins on BBC or ITV, which is the other major broadcaster in the UK.
Peter, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Peter Goddard is a lecturer in media and communications at the University of Liverpool and part of the team that produced the study called Media Wars. John Pilger is a London-based journalist, author, and documentarian. He doesn't find the results surprising. In his column this week in The New Statesman, he wrote that the British study echoes the findings of Daniel Hallin's book, The Uncensored War, about the way the media covered the war in Vietnam.
I mean, they both have this in common, that whereas journalists famously covering the Vietnam War, and I did, I'm talking about American journalists, Western journalists, were critical of the U.S. conduct of the war, they rarely seriously challenged what the war was really about, the motives of the war. It was almost always dressed up, as the current Iraq one often is, as well-meaning.
These were the findings in the book, The Uncensored War.
Yeah. And it was quite an unusual study because it challenged the whole idea that the liberal media had been so uniformly opposed to the war that it helped to lose it and undermine the war effort. That just simply wasn't true, this idea. But it was an entrenched one, and it went in to the military consciousness in the United States. And you saw the invasion of Panama, which was George Bush Sr.'s invasion. You saw that being very, very media controlled. And that was really the first of its kind post-Vietnam. And they've all since been, in varying degrees, media controlled. Of course, you can't control. But I don't think there's anyone in this country, anyway, that doubts what a total disaster and horror the Iraq war is. They shake their heads. But the motives, the underlying motives, I don't think are still seriously challenged as they should be.
When you look at the British press, though, you don't see it as a monolith, do you?
No, it's not monolithic as such. There's no conspiracy. There doesn't have to be. You know, it's like Mr. Murdoch famously saying, you know, I never tell my editors what to do. Well, he doesn't have to. Spanish Civil War, the invasion of Iraq, Vietnam, Kosovo. I mean, there's nothing new about the media playing a compliant role. Because although we live with the romance, if you like, of the media, the press being a fourth estate, it isn't. It's an extension of established order.
Language, as you've noted, plays a big role. You wrote about the language the press uses in describing the intentions of Western governments.
Yeah, language, cliches, jargon. You know, it's like war on terror. What on earth is terror? What you know, I mean, is it a country or what? Well, no, it isn't. I mean, so that if that's not in quotation marks, then it's propaganda. Collateral Damage appeared in an editorial in The Guardian the other day without quotation marks. And as I remember, I'm pretty sure that was invented in the Vietnam War to describe killing civilians. There's other more subtle jargon, that the use of noble words, if you like democracy. Well, what does it mean? In these buzzwords, as I think the advertising industry call them, they are loaded. And it's not the journalist's role to propagate loaded terms. We should explain as well as report.
Thank you very much.
All right, you're welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
John Pilger's columns and documentaries can be found at johnpilger.com.
John Pilger isn't the only one to question the loaded language of war. This week, none other than outgoing Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld offered some second thoughts on word choice. Asked if there was anything different he'd have done in Iraq, Rumsfeld offered, "I don't think I would have called it a war on terror." Oh, really? With fatal mistakes in troop levels, equally fatal underestimation of a few dead-enders, hundreds of thousands dead, a society in ruins, a breeding ground for terrorism where before there was none, and the defense secretary regrets his phrasing? It's not the war he'd wish to change, it's the Pentagon's spin on it. Because the word war, he says, makes people think it will come to a neat conclusion, and because terror isn't the enemy, just the tactic of the enemy. Of course, over the past 6 years, Rumsfeld had many opportunities to change the spin, but he clung to war on terror like a magic talisman. And no wonder, it was a linguistic trump card justifying anything the administration did on grounds of national security. In fact, last year, faced with criticism about the whole nomenclature surrounding Iraq, Rumsfeld said, "Let there be no mistake, we are a nation at war against terrorist enemies who are seeking our surrender or our retreat. It is a war." But I guess not a war. Unfortunately, endless struggle against ruthless fanatics, criminals, and opportunists doesn't fit well in a cable news headline. And Vietnam is already taken.
Coming up, spying in plain sight and a transcontinental tug of war over copyright.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, featuring a new book by Carl Schramm, The Entrepreneurial Imperative, at kauffman.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning, at digitallearning.macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Ever since 9/11 exposed fatal flaws in the U.S. intelligence apparatus, the 16 U.S. intelligence agencies have struggled to update their infrastructure. In a recent piece in the New York Times Magazine, Clive Thompson tells the story of Matthew Burton, hired in 2003 by the Defense Intelligence Agency, who was thrilled to finally get his hands on the high-tech spookware that he thought would come with the job. At the very least, the 22-year-old assumed, he'd have the same relatively efficient communication afforded to any civilian who uses the internet, like email and instant messaging. But no, instead of finding that anything civilians could do, spies could do better, Burton confronted hopelessly antiquated technology. Agencies could barely talk amongst themselves, let alone to each other. These tools are improving, says Clive Thompson, but the outside world has gotten a serious head start.
I talked to CIA analysts and operatives who would try and send something to the FBI, like just a basic file, and they would call and go, well, you know, it didn't get here. Can you fax it? And they'd go, well, okay, and they'd fax it. And then, you know, the FBI guys would go, well, the system says it arrives, but we can't find it, so can you courier it over? This is happening 3 or 4 years ago.
So not to put too fine a point on it, those scenes we see in movies where the star types in a name into his or her computer and all of a sudden gets cross-referenced files from everybody in the intelligence world and can pinpoint everything he or she needs to know, that's all fiction.
Yeah. No. That's very much fiction. I mean, it's kind of funny. You know, I'm a big fan of 24, and they're always doing this hilarious stuff like, you know, give me everything on this person. They punch a name into a search engine and they get maps of the person's house and all sorts of information about their domestic life and international records. In the real world of intelligence, a lot of that stuff would be warehoused in different databases, and you'd have to go out there and really stitch it together.
So now we have a Directorate of National Intelligence, to which all of the various intelligence agencies are now responsible. What are they doing about it?
They're starting to borrow some of the ideas that you see out on the open internet. One of them is this thing called Intellipedia, which is essentially a Wikipedia for spies. Anyone who visits it can edit or change or write a page.
So there's a question for you. I guess you have essentially two choices. Number one, to use the very limited number of people with extremely high security clearances and therefore access to lots and lots of classified information, or to widen the net to include those who aren't necessarily the possessor of a lot of secrets but just might be able to add to the conversation. Does the intelligence community have any idea yet which yields better results?
No, I don't think they do, because Intellipedia is a fairly new experiment. It only went online earlier this year. It's already got thousands and thousands of articles. But you raised a really good point, which is that there's at least three major levels of classification. At the top secret level is a small number. Secret, there's a slightly larger number. Unclassified is a very large number. Then there's actually three versions of Intellipedia, you know, for each of those levels. Now, the guys at the top, they've got all sorts of great secret information. But on the other hand, the guys at the bottom have numbers in their favor. They've got huge numbers of people contributing. The one thing that I heard over and over again is that it used to be that the job of spy agencies were to go and get those few little precious secrets that would tell you the most important things you need to know about the Soviet Union. And now they're realizing is that there's so much information publicly out there on the internet that it's becoming more important to be able to sift through that than it is to sort of go in and, in a clandestine way, ferret out a secret.
At some point, though, don't the intelligence services find themselves just so inundated with information that they can't find the needle in the haystack?
If you take a look at the way the internet works right now, it's very good at finding the needles in the haystack or finding the valuable nuggets. And so the question is, can things like Intellipedia do the same thing for the enormous sea of information that the spies deal with every day? The reason why Google is so good is because Google relies on ordering our results based on what sites are the most popular. Google says, if this site that says the word Clive Thompson has 100 links pointing to it, it's more reliable than one that has only 5 links pointing to it. The problem that the spies have is that they have their own personal internet and there's no linking on it. There's no people out there blogging. There's no one out there doing that sort of social glue that says, hey, here's a link to this great study. It's amazing. And 10 people link to it. So when their search engine goes out there, yeah, it can find all the files that say Clive Thompson, but it can't organize them because it doesn't have any social information.
There are laws as to how much sharing intelligence agencies can actually do. The CIA, for example, is not allowed to spy on American citizens in America. if the CIA starts sharing its data with, let's say, the FBI, isn't that a violation of U.S. law?
It certainly could be. Yeah, absolutely. And this is the big question as to how promiscuous can you be with this data? In practice, it seems as though they're, by and large, very careful about this. You know, some of it's self-preservation. Agents can be charged, you know, if they violate any laws. There are some possible technical solutions to this. The Markle Foundation has done a series of excellent reports. One of their participants in their studies has proposed a very clever way of just essentially encrypting all the information that's deeply secret. So it all goes out on the internet, but no human can read it. Search engines can. And so essentially, you know, you might have someone at the CIA goes, well, I'm interested in who might know about Al-Qaeda in Arizona. And so they type that stuff in. And what they get back is not a file, but essentially just a pointer to a person in Arizona and saying, you know, go talk to this person. We can't tell you what they know, but they might be useful to you.
That would have been very useful around September 10th, 2001.
Absolutely.
The State Department was trying to get some information about Iranians involved in their secret nuclear program. And the CIA, for reasons of protecting sources and methods, said, we're not going to give you that information. So the State Department goes onto Google with a junior employee searching around and comes up with 12 names. And these people are now going to have travel bans against them. Is that what we have to look forward to?
Well, it's entirely possible that if these spy agencies become a lot more interested in what they call open source information, which means for them public information on the internet, that, yeah. So I talked to a young analyst who had done a report for his manager, and it had been done entirely with information that he'd found on the internet. And he'd spent months working on this, and he'd pulled together really a fantastic threat report. And he handed it to his boss, and his boss read it and said, this is great. I'm going to pass this up the food chain. But before I do, I need you to sprinkle in a few pieces of human intelligence just to make it look as though we used covert agents to help create this report. So what his boss was telling him was that you have produced an amazing piece of intelligence just using stuff on the internet, but for reasons of politics, we need to make it look as though we needed to have the spies out there, basically.
Yeah, go create the illusion that what we do is still relevant.
Well, the fact of the matter is, obviously, it still requires someone with an analyst's skills to be able to pull together a good threat report. You and I probably couldn't do that because we wouldn't know what to look for. We wouldn't understand the context. But maybe the nature of what intelligence is changing.
All right. Clive, as always, thank you so much.
No problem. I enjoyed it.
Clive Thompson is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine.
A year ago, England's Chancellor of the Exchequer wanted recommendations on how the UK should tweak its intellectual property laws. So he commissioned Andrew Gowers, a former editor of the Financial Times. Last week, Gowers released a 150-page report with the overall message that the intellectual property system in England does not need radical overhaul. And one point in particular that Gowers singled out for not reforming was the recording copyright term. In the UK, a recording becomes part of the public domain after 50 years, while in the US, it takes 95 years for a recording to become public property. Gowers concluded that in the UK, 50 years is long enough, but the British recording industry has launched a PR campaign to convince lawmakers to extend the copyright term to 95 years. A full-page ad from Phonographic Performance Limited, which collects royalties on behalf of British musicians and record companies, appeared in the Financial Times the day after the report was released, demanding, quote, fair play for musicians, with 4,500 musicians' signatures. But, as Stanford professor and blogger Lawrence Lessig pointed out, some of the artists who sign the advertisement won't be collecting royalties no matter how long the copyright term is. They're dead. Copyright terms don't mean much to the deceased, but they mean a lot to those small label owners who re-release great music from all those great musicians, and ultimately to the music fans who buy it. On the Media's Rex Doan has a huge collection of this re-released music, called reissues, and he has the story.
The earliest reissue labels helped appease the needs of hardcore jazz fiends as far back as the 30s. But the big explosion in reissue activity occurred in the late 60s when dozens of rediscovered folk and blues artists played the festival circuit. Small labels like Arhuli and Yazoo spurred the revival by reissuing rare original recordings of blues pioneers such as Blind Boy Fuller and Memphis Minnie.
I got a big black cat sitting in my back door.
The reissue market evolved quickly. In 1975, the Bear Family label out of Germany began issuing definitive box sets of vintage American music. Nothing like it had ever been seen before. Bear Family founder Richard Weitzer.
I'm not interested in money. I just want to see a good product out. I would even put out a record if I only know I only can sell 100 copies if I find it worthwhile.
Elaborate Bear Family releases, like their 12-CD Carter Family box set, are prized by collectors, but carry a price tag too hefty to lure most casual fans.
I don't think about the customer. I want to satisfy me. I don't care about the customer. The customer has to take what I'm presenting.
While Weitzer patiently strives to manufacture lavish living monuments to the artists he loves, Gilles Petard of the Classics label in France has a much more urgent approach. Simply put, Petard wants to reissue the complete recorded works in chronological order of all major and minor jazz, blues, and R&B artists who ever recorded in America. That includes well-known artists and the hopelessly obscure.
To me, this is a very important point, you know, and I think that's the great thing about a series like this, is that you can put out names that normally you would not be able to.
Names like Little Miss Cornshucks, a surprise bestseller in the Classics series.
Tell me, Papa Tree Top, what you try to do to me.
Unlike high-end reissue labels like Bear Family, which prefers to lease master tapes for optimum sound quality, Petard dubs directly from the original discs and only releases material that has fallen into public domain. Since copyright protection of American sound recordings ends after 50 years in Europe, that leaves plenty of material for Petard. Little wonder he's put out over 1,000 CDs to date. But there is growing resentment in the States over the flood of public domain reissues coming out of Europe. While U.S. label owners might have been able to look the other way when modest selling material from their catalog was being copied and sold abroad, the unthinkable will soon be happening when the never-endingly lucrative recordings of early rock and rollers like Elvis Presley, Chuck Berry, and Little Richard turn 50. John Singleton, president of Sun Entertainment.
We consider them legal bootleggers because, you know, they had absolutely nothing to do with creating it, and they're throwing back, our creations to us without any compensation to the owners of the masters, the record companies, or to the artists and, their families.
Back in 1969, Singleton's father bought the rights to Sun Records, whose catalog includes the works of Elvis, Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Roy Orbison. All steady-selling records for generations, now set to go into public domain abroad. Singleton says copyright protection of American sound recordings in Europe should be extended to 95 years, precisely the same period of protection that European recordings enjoy in the U.S.
I think if our government should, apply some pressure on the European Union to change the law.
For a family-run operation like Sun Entertainment, which actively markets its archives, the European incursion is likely to hurt. But the back catalog for most of the other early independent labels like Excello and Imperial have largely been ignored by the media conglomerates that now own them. It's a point not lost on Charlie Lang.
To me, the reissue market to the majors is more like a stepchild, you know. They'll throw a little money at it when they have to, when nothing else seems to be working.
Lang runs the online mail order business BluebeatMusic.com, which serves both as a retail outlet for hard-to-find reissues and as a one-man blues crusade.
it's kind of duplicitous for these companies to push for an extension of copyright and not having any intention whatsoever of putting it out. The gimme mine now and I'm going to keep it forever mentality has locked up a lot of American treasures in corporate vaults.
And they're reticent to turn the keys over to anyone, here or abroad.
I know independent record companies here in the States who would love to reissue many of the old recordings.
John Broven has worked on dozens of reissue products for the Ace record label out of London.
But when they approach a major label and are told that they need to guarantee 25,000 CD sales for a project which is clearly only going to sell, say, 5,000 copies, then that music is just going to lie dormant in the vaults. Nothing is going to happen.
Despite the reluctance of some major labels to strike reasonable leasing deals and the tug of war over copyright protection, copyright attorney Bob Clarida of Cowan, Leibowitz & Lattman says salvation could be on the horizon, or more precisely, on the Internet.
If all the record company has to do is digitize an old tape sitting in a vault somewhere, it's very low cost. So, you know, the very technology that has caused so much problem for the record business in the commercial world, I think is going to make it much, much easier for people to gain access to all sorts of archival work that previously has not been commercially viable.
The format shift from CD to MP3 is inevitable, but pessimistic music snobs fear there'll be a considerable wait for any musical treasures to emerge again from the back catalog. Some even contend that after all the countless mergers and staff layoffs, most of the major music corporations don't even know what they've got locked away. Case in point. A couple of years ago, a small label that prefers to remain anonymous got an offer to license a blues track they had just reissued without permission. The offer came from a major label. The track they wanted to lease was something the major already owned. The small label responded accordingly. It took the money. For On the Media in New York, I'm Rex Doan.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, and Mark Phillips, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Alicia Rebensdorf and Michael McLaughlin. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.